Hi there. We have a favor to ask. If you're enjoying the DLC Live podcast and you're listening on a platform that lets you leave a rating or a review, leave us a 5-star rating. Maybe take a minute to write a quick review. It really helps and we really appreciate it. Now let's get on with the show. Welcome to DLC Live, your source for educational and inspirational interviews with mental health experts and advocates from around the world. Now, here's your host, creator of the DLC Anxiety Worldwide Mental Health Community, Dean Stott.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, everyone. Today's a really good live with the wonderful Kimberly Quinlan from, you know it. She's from the recovery room every Friday. She's also a very good peer, virtual buddy, and an amazing therapist. And we're going to be listening to Kimberly's story regarding anxiety, what she does as a therapist, and also a little bit about her story, her journey to recovery. And we're going to be answering some of the questions that you guys sent in. So yeah, buckle up, stay tight, guys, and let's get Kim on.
Good morning.
Good evening. Hi, Kim, are you okay?
I'm great. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So you're back now. You're back to your normal setting, yeah?
I am. I'm finally back. I'm not thrilled about it, but I'm getting used to it.
Fantastic. Well, I don't know, yeah. Kim, thank you so much for coming on. We should have done this a long time ago, but glad to have you here now. If you can just explain to the followers, obviously, they see you every Friday in the recovery room. Just a brief explanation about why you have your Instagram community, your own personal journey of anxiety recovery, and just everything you do as a therapist.
Sure. Yeah. So I am, let me just turn my light up here a little. I am a marriage and family therapist, and I am a specialist in anxiety. Under the umbrella of anxiety are different diagnoses that I treat. And the reason I kind of fell into that was, number one, I had a sort of personal vested interest in treating anxiety, but by luck, I got assigned to a anxiety specialist center where I did my internship, and I got to do really, really in-depth training on specific types of training specifically for the different diagnoses. So that was so cool, and I fell in love with it. And then from there, it's just been an ongoing sort of attempt to educate. I think so many people think that anxiety is like a blanket term and they all sort of have the same treatment. And my hope is sort of to help people understand that there are specific little tweaks to different types of treatment that can help significantly.
Yeah, fantastic. And just regarding you went through an anxiety disorder, is that correct?
Well, I originally had an eating disorder, which I personally consider an anxiety disorder because it was anxiety filled the entire time, even though it's better understood as an eating disorder. Yeah. I had compulsive exercise and anorexia and, have struggled a lot in the area of eating disorders with also just general anxiety, worrying about what people think of me or perfectionism and many different expressions. So I have been in recovery for about a decade. And I'm just so grateful that I got the right care, right? And the right help.
Yeah. So once you'd recovered, had you then gone down the therapist route, or had you already been looking into being a therapist? What is it that made you want to become a therapist and obviously have your CBT school, which I'd love for you to explain to everyone what that is, because I'm a real advocate for CBT and how effective it is for anxiety disorders, especially panic disorder, is something that really helped me in my recovery as well. So to see that you're able to have a whole school there that's really, it can reach the masses, can't it? It's not just for a certain type of clientele, which I think is amazing. So if you can just tell us all about your school.
Of course. So I have a private practice where I have a therapist who work for me. And unfortunately, we just had to keep turning people away, whether they weren't in our state or we were full or that that was too expensive, because here in America, it is very, very expensive, as I'm sure it is in many countries. And I was just, this is heartbreaking just to be like sending people to nowhere. And so out of a moment of frustration, I was trying to think of like, how can I make this work? You know, I can't employ all the people. But so I created these courses, and they're using CBT, the same exact tools we use with our therapists and our clients. And it's basically me just showing people who don't have access to therapy. I always say, if you have access, by all means, get therapy first. But if you don't have access for one or many reasons, this just walks you through the steps on how you can apply it to yourself. So it's been great. And the fun thing about having CBT school is I've got to meet all the wonderful people like yourself.
And with the CBT school, is that like a self-taught thing that the person will do? Or are they guided at all? Do they have like any correspondence with any of the therapists or anything like that? Or is it just literally they do the work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's not therapy. So it is a self-led, the courses are self-led. However, I'll also say there's tons of free resources there as well, right? So we do have paid courses, but we have free courses and we have a ton of free stuff as well. But once you're in the course, you can ask questions. There's a Q&A box, but I don't give personal advice in those because it would be unethical for me to give advice specifically without assessing a person. I try to make sure it's really ethical and we follow all the legal rules.
Like the psychoeducation like we give on Instagram. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then every second Monday, I have a slotted time where I meet on Instagram and I answer all the questions of people who take the course. So or people who don't take the course, right? So if you've we walk through and we would explain how you would do it yourself, but there's always those questions of like, well, what about this one part of my disorder? What about, and so my hope is that those lives give people sort of a little extra information to help them get on the way.
Oh, no, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And is it all year round, Kim? Or,
all year.
Pardon?
Yeah, it's all year. We used to just do it twice a year and have it be open. But since COVID, there was such a huge need for people, particularly people who had OCD and hair pulling and skin picking. They were really struggling. And so we just opened it up for all year round.
Yeah. I'll just get on to some of the questions from the wonderful community. First one is there any anxiety disorders that CBT can't tackle? So is there anybody who's dealing with anxiety who you say, yeah, maybe don't go down the CBT route, or would you say it's for everyone?
Well, I think it's important first for everyone to understand what CBT is. So it's not this scary treatment, right? It's really just looking at your thoughts. So cognitive is looking at your thoughts and correcting some thoughts that maybe aren't so helpful. And then it's looking at your behaviors and challenging and changing your behaviors that aren't so helpful. So there can be no harm done by CBT. In fact, we have so much research to show that CBT has helped all of the anxiety disorders, even post-traumatic stress disorder, OCD. The thing to remember though is, and think of it like, if you saw the word, so CBT is an acronym. If you saw the C and the B and the T, that you would assume that it's equal cognitive and equal behavioral. But each disorder has a variation. Some disorders like social anxiety will spend more time on the cognition, so a bigger C, and the B might be a little smaller in ratio. Whereas if you have, let's say, OCD or panic disorder, you might spend more time on the B, the behavioral part of cognitive behavioral therapy, and less time on the C. So depending on the disorder, there's just little variations that we do. But CBT is CBT is something I even teach my children, who haven't got an anxiety disorder. I think they're just skills for life that everyone should have.
No, definitely. Introducing it into the educational system, I think, is a, yeah. is a really. Hopefully we can see that over the years to come. So obviously CBT, you just said that there's different aspects to it. So there's certain areas where you'd focus on the cognitive, certain areas where you'd focus on the behavioral. If somebody was coming into the CBT school, how would they know which part to focus on? Is it quite self-explanatory for them?
Yeah, so the course we have for OCD is all directed towards a kind of CBT we call exposure and response prevention. And so that's really heavy on behavioral. So it will just take you through that with hair pulling and skin picking, which is under the umbrella of OCD. We focus a little on both, and it's all laid out there as well. And we're right now in the current, we're in the process right now of creating a course for social anxiety and one for panic and one for depression as well. So we really want to, we're working towards making sure each course, you don't have to really do your research because I have done mine, is just leading you down the ratios of what C and B should be.
And obviously we know, especially from a scientific background, how useful CBT is for anxiety disorders. Obviously the combination with medication, it shows the best results in large studies, which is amazing to see. You just mentioned that you're going to be doing it on depression. Is the science backed up on depression as well?
Yes. So as you can imagine, a lot of depression lies, right? We know depression just lies to us all day and tells us how bad we are and how bad the world is. And so there is a very heavy emphasis on cognitive therapy. But it's also important that we don't miss the behavioral part, because when we're depressed, what do we want to do? We want to stay in bed. We want to engage in behaviors, maybe substance use and so forth. So it's important that we also address the behavioral piece as well. And a lot of that behavioral is really just structuring your day so that depression isn't running the day and instead your values and you are running the day. So that's sort of the combination for depression.
And when you look at the science, some psychiatrists, psychologists actually believe that depression and anxiety could be under like two sides of the same coin almost. Mm-hmm. Really interesting. I do know there's further studies into that, and it'll be really interesting to see what they say, because you can see where a lot of the symptoms overlap, and you can obviously see why you would be anxious if you were depressed and vice versa.
Exactly. It'll
be interesting to see the results from that. The next question, Kim, is, what would you say to a therapist who is disregarding medication for anxiety?
Well, I've got two answers to that. So as a client, if I was a patient of someone, what would I say? I would probably say, can you give me some medical or scientific evidence to back that up? Clients can be empowered to question your therapist. I encourage my clients to question me. I encourage them to say, where are you getting this data from, right? And so I think it's important, if your therapist is saying as a client not to take meds, you might want to check in with them and ask them to show you data. P.S. The trick is there isn't any data for that. I mean, it's a personal choice. But we have lots of evidence to show that medicine is incredibly helpful for those. And you get to choose, not the therapist. As a clinician, if I heard another therapist say that, I would very strongly question their ethics, because we as clinicians have to stay in what we call our scope of practice, which means we're only to speak on things we're very, very fluent in, right? I'm always really honest in my lives that I do on Instagram. If someone asks me a question that isn't my specialty, I don't answer it, because I try to stay within my scope of practice. And so if I see a clinician who's speaking outside of their scope of practice, I might have them maybe, you know, check in with them, not call them out, but we call it calling them in, which is saying, hey, it might be really helpful if you check your own personal bias on that before you, you know, preach that to vulnerable people.
And you can understand, it's interesting that how personal bias can sometimes shine through with some therapists. So there's so many questions, Kim. How long does it take, how many sessions would you need to show a positive effect with anxiety disorders, and is it different for different ones? So is it different for social anxiety panic disorder, or is it an individual approach for each person?
Right. So I always have a hard time answering this because, let's say, on the science side of things, they say around 12 sessions, you should start to see some benefits. But I'm hesitant to say that because that's the science.
Is that because it studies the 12-week progress? They then studied it and saw what improvements they'd made over that time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that's for most therapy. I mean, to start with, you might feel worse, right? To start with therapy, you might feel worse. You're looking at scary thoughts and you're facing scary behaviors. So, you know, it's not going to be a linear process. Science shows around 12, but I'm always really reluctant because that doesn't take into account whether there's more than one diagnosis, right? It doesn't take into account that rapport that's being built with the patient and their cognitive abilities, right? So when you're super anxious, it's hard to concentrate and it's hard to understand certain topics and skills. So I think it's very dependent on the person. I've had clients who felt immediately helped, not at all in recovery, but by just understanding their just being a significant reduction of stress. Whereas other disorders like OCD requires us to go through quite a treatment plan before you may start to feel any reduction of symptoms.
And what are people saying? Where can they find you on Instagram if you just want to give you a tag out?
Sure. So I'm at Kimberly Quinlan. So, and it's Kimberly with an L-E-Y, not L-Y. So my parents just throw in a random E in my name. So it's Kimberly Quinlan.
I thought that was an Australian thing, no?
It is. It is an Australian thing. Yeah. But all my family has like a special letter thrown in somewhere.
The next question, Kim, is what would you tell another therapist or a colleague who was suffering anxiety? What would your advice to them be?
Go to therapy. Right? I even had to call myself. I'll be honest. I had to call myself out on this the other week. We can't be buying into this idea that as clinicians, we have it all figured out, right? If you were a plumber, you might be able to do your own plumbing, right? Because it's just your plumbing. However, if you're a therapist and you're struggling with anxiety, you might be missing some things because you're the one in the problem. And so go to therapy. There's absolutely no shame. In fact, I would say a good therapist goes to therapy. And so I'd say find a colleague who you trust. It can be difficult because sometimes the colleagues you trust are your friends and you can't go and see your friend as your therapist, but find a colleague that you trust. And by all means, there is no shame in going to therapy for anybody.
No, definitely. And that leads nicely into the next question, which is if you're seeing positive effects with CBT and it looks like the person's overcome an anxiety disorder, would you advise them to then just cut off the CBT sessions, or is it worthwhile them still checking in, say, every couple of weeks, etc.?
Yeah, so the way that we do it is sometimes cutting it off right away can be a little jarring, and it doesn't take into account just daily stresses, particularly in this particular year and last year, right? So even though you're doing really well, you may want to check in for those daily stresses. But the way that we do it is we go weekly and then we go bi-weekly, and we check to see if you went every second week, so bi-monthly, I should say. So then you go every second week and we check in to say, was there any relapse? Was there any reduction in your skills? And we check. And if not, and they're successful at 2, we then move it to 3 weeks. And we're really just testing to see whether the behavior change and the cognitive change has stuck. Now, there's no shame for those who it doesn't stick. We all struggle in different ways. But that can really be the thing that determines the frequency and then how separated we have the sessions. And that's the way we do it. And it's actually really helpful because it helps the client check in with themselves and go, how am I doing? They do a little assessment on themselves midweek. How am I doing? Am I doing my homework? What have I started to lapse on or be a little loose with? And that really, that insight can be really helpful for recovery as well.
Yeah, there's so many questions that are popping up in my mind as well. So I'm just going to ask you all the questions.
I'm here. Just give them to me. I'm ready.
So if a client's in crisis, can they reach out to someone, one of the therapists, outside the sessions?
Yes. So again, with different disorders, we treat them somewhat different, not entirely different. But let's say you have a client who is panicking. Mm-hmm. And they call and they say, I'm panicking, help me. We would then make a clinical and ethical decision on whether having that connection outside of the therapy is actually helpful for them or not. Because we don't want to disempower our patients by the patient thinking that they can only handle a panic attack if we're by their side, right? So we would have to make that decision as a clinician based on the case. There will be someone, let's say if they are in, it depends on what we consider a crisis, is if, let's say, their dog passed away or they've had to face their 10 out of 10 fear and we hadn't yet prepared for that. We absolutely would be there to support them, remind them of their skills, you know, sort of keep them on track and encourage them. So I think it depends on whether the support outside of therapy benefits them in terms of their empowerment.
That's a real good answer. So really, you don't want to go down the road of them using you as a crutch, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. And we're not doing that because we don't want to spend our time with the client, we don't enjoy them or thoroughly appreciate them. We have to sort of constantly as clinicians be making decisions on what's in their best interest. And sometimes that's not what they want to hear. But through that modeling, it's a really great lesson.
No, that's wonderful. One of the other questions is, do you think anxiety disorders should have a multidisciplinary approach? And like, do you practice that? So like, do you work with GPs and psychiatrists as well as therapists?
1,000%. Yes. So your treatment is going to go so much better if you are willing to allow your clinicians and your doctors and your support team to communicate. Even though it might feel shameful and you might be afraid that your doctor is talking to your therapist behind your back, but they're never doing it out of any ill will. It's so helpful. All of our patients and clients will often sign a release. It's important that you get a signed release before we speak to anyone because we wouldn't want to breach their confidentiality. But then we talk to them about little things that are showing up. And through those communications, once we're all on the same team, we're working really effectively. It can be a problem, right? If the doctor is working in this direction and we're working in this direction, this is really common with health anxiety, is if we can be on the same team with their GP and psychiatrist, we can help the GP to know which answers, which questions to answer so that it's not becoming compulsive. There's so many benefits to having connection between all of them.
No, that's wonderful. Can CBT be used to overcome the irrational fear of suddenly being allergic to specific foods? It's a very specific question, but there you go, Kim.
No, it's a great question. So the thing to remember here is everybody has thoughts and everybody has safety behaviors. Safety behaviors are things we do to avoid discomfort, right? So in this particular case, it's the fear of food. Was it allergic reaction to food? Yeah. So you have the irrational thought, which we would address and we would maybe if there's any psychoeducation we needed to do. And then we would change their behavior towards that. And my guess is it's usually going to be avoidant behaviors. So we would practice facing the things that we avoid. So here's something to remember for all the listeners. In almost all of the anxiety disorders, there are usually 4 or 5 behaviors that can show up. One is a physical behavior, right? Something we do physically to avoid fear. The next one is a mental behavior where we mentally ruminate. The third is avoidance, which is where we avoid the fear. And the last main one is reassurance seeking, right? So in this case, they may, before they eat, go, are you sure this won't make me allergic? Are you sure? Like, they might Google it, right? And then the last one is self-punishment. So that when that one shows up often with some people, in that because they have the fear, then they beat themselves up for having the fear. And every
I think we lost Kim there. I've sent another request. It was so interesting as well, wasn't it, guys? So if you just hold on, hopefully she'll come back. Not sure what happened with the signal.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Yeah, I think your signal.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, your signal keeps lagging a little bit, but yeah, you're back with us, Kim. Okay. Yeah, sorry. So we were speaking about the specific fear of an allergic reaction to food. Obviously, with anyone like having a new food, there's always going to be that risk there of not knowing, isn't there? I might not have tried something, and there is a possibility if I was to eat it that maybe I would have an allergic reaction. But we really can't go through life trying to weigh out them risks, can we? Because there's a risk to everything.
Yeah, this is showing up a lot with people's anxiety about the vaccine too, right? Is, you know, and I think it's true. You have to weigh up your values, right? You have to weigh up what's right for you within the case of this food. Is, do you want fear to win or do you want your values to win? And just keep asking yourself that question, right? Do you know, and I think the main thing here to remember is just because there's fear doesn't mean there's technically danger. And it's our job to allow fear, right? You know, just because there's fear doesn't mean we even have to do anything. Sometimes we can just feel fear and still do the hard thing every single day.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot with anxiety as well, doesn't it? Do you know where you get an irrational thought, but then you have a physical response, so your body reacts with your heart racing or whatever, and then you can falsely then think that because your body's reacted this way that the thought is more realistic.
100%, right? It's a threat response. And so you're to look for trends, right? If you start to see constantly that your brain is sending out a fear or threat response, your job is to just actually start to have a better, like I always talk with my patients about having a relationship with fear, right? And so that when fear shows up, you don't do everything it tells you to do. Instead, you might just go, oh, I notice fear is here. Okay, interesting. Be curious about it instead of like listening to what fear has to say and taking that as the truth. Just like if you were to go onto the internet, you're not going to believe everything you read. You have to be a wise consumer, and we have to be wise consumers with fear as well.
No, that's a really good answer. Is general anxiety disorder treated differently than panic disorder? The community member thinks that they've got both, so would they be able to tackle both of them together? Especially like school, for example.
Yeah. So no, 100%, right? So these are probably the most commonly studied, and we have a lot of research about how effective CBT is for these types of disorders, more than OCD and other anxiety disorders. And so you can do them because, to be honest, the skills are going to be very much the same, right? With panic, it's going to feel a lot harder, right? And you're going to have to ride some really painful waves of anxiety without engaging in avoidant behaviors. But that's also the same for generalized anxiety. The difference is that with generalized anxiety, it's usually around daily stresses. And sometimes you do need to do more cognitive work around, you know, maybe correcting some really irrational expectations you have or beliefs you have that are creating more stress. So I'll give you an example. If you're going to school, starting school is a stressful thing. But if you have the underlying belief or thought that everyone must like me, well, you're going to have so much more anxiety. So we may actually shift that thought to, it's okay if some people don't like me, right? Or I don't have to get everyone's approval to be a good student. And so sometimes it's just making little tweaks to some cognitions.
Yeah, great answer again, Kim. Yeah, 10 out of 10 with these answers. the next one is, what's the reason that CBT therapy doesn't work from what you've seen? So is there any trends to why it doesn't work? Because there's such good evidence, isn't there, for it working. So why on some occasions do you think it misses the mark?
Well, I think that the cool thing is about CBT is the community of CBT therapists are very welcome to add in complementary treatments. And so an example would be, I could do exposures with my clients with OCD all day. But if I'm just doing that behavioral work and I'm not slowing down to acknowledge the shame that shows up for them and the anxiety that shows up for them, it may be just very, very harsh, right? And so what we do is we use complementary treatments like mindful and self-compassion or acceptance and commitment therapy. Sometimes a client who is really dysregulated may need the complementary treatment called dialectical behavior therapy. And so I think that sometimes clinicians only use CBT without acknowledging that sometimes we can actually beautifully incorporate other treatment modalities. Not that it needs to derail the treatment plan, but those little additional complemental treatments can be so great at catching the roadblocks to recovery, right? Could be emotional dysregulation. It could be high levels of depression. It could be trauma. It could be a stressful environment. And so we sort of often try to have complementary treatment for people who struggle.
Just for people who don't know what DBT is, are you okay to just give a quick explanation? Why it's obviously good with CBT?
Yeah, so cognitive behavioral therapy is similar to dialectical behavioral therapy. It's a behavioral therapy modality, but it focuses on strong, strong emotions. It was originally made for people who are suicidal and self-harming, but now we know we can use it for any very strong emotion. And the whole concept is that we can hold two opposing truths at the same time, right? And so what it's saying is you can be anxious and go to school at the same time, right? Because our brain tells us if we're anxious, we can't, right? You can be angry and communicate effectively at the same time. So dialectical behavioral therapy helps us to accept the emotion that we feel, but also be flexible in our response to it. Right? So if you're panicking, you might have the panic attack and be flexible in still engaging in washing the dishes. And both of those two things can happen at the same time.
No, that's really good. So like just for an example of like if you was panicking and washing the dishes, you said that with DBT, you would continue to wash and be panicking. How would CBT approach that situation differently?
Well, so CBT would approach it in this exact same behavioral way, but DBT addresses it a little different cognitively. So they bring in a heavy dose of mindfulness training, right?
Right.
They also practice, if clients are dysregulating, so they're harming themselves, or they're, you know, spiraling emotionally, they may engage in small bursts of behavior change that's not related to dishwashing, right? So they may engage in, you know, sometimes there's the three main they use is called TIP, which is a temperature change. It might be some kind of intense exercise just for a 10-15 second block. And then, or it might be some kind of progressive relaxation, but that's only for a very short period of time. And then you're to return right back to doing the dishes, right? And so they implement these little tiny behavioral changes that sometimes can sort of trip the system to help them to be able to do the CBT.
Fantastic. Kim, that's all the questions and obviously all the wonderful answers. Sorry, there's just one more. Just feeling like crying without any reason, would you say this is healthy or not? It looks like we may have lost Kim again with the signal. There must be a signal shortage in Los Angeles. But guys, what an amazing chat that was with Kimberly, and really, really thankful for her wisdom, for all the knowledge that she just shared with the community. And you guys, if you want to check Kimberly out, it's at Kimberly Quinlan. You can check her out. She's on the recovery room panel as well every Friday. And I do, also we share some of Kim's posts as well when we can. So you'll be seeing them on a weekly basis. So CBT School as well, if you go onto her profile, you'll be able to get all the links to the CBT School. And I'll also do a like a story swipe up so you can get straight there. But thank you so much, everyone, for staying in. Thank you. Really appreciate it. Let me just see if Kim is on to say bye to everyone. I think she's come back on. Yes, I will be saving the wire 100%. Kim, I don't know what is happening. You haven't been paying the internet bill, I don't think.
You know what's funny is throughout the whole time we've done recovery rooms, while we do them, my daughter and my son are on Zoom. So I have more internet, and now they're in school. I have more internet than I've ever had. I don't understand what's happening.
Now, I was just telling everyone where they can find you, Kim, but now you're back on. If you can just let them know. Is there a certain age that you have to be to do CBT school or to see a therapist at your practice? And also everyone's asking where they can find you on Instagram and if you have any books coming up or anything.
I do. So in terms of age, CBT can be for anybody. So face-to-face, you can start at any age. The courses, a lot of the time, the parents will take, and they can start to implement some of the skills and the education with their child if their child is too young to sit through a 6 or 7 hour course on how to do this kind of work. And so that's often better implemented by a parent anyway. In terms of me, so yes, you can follow me at Kimberly Quinlan, or you can go to cbtschool.com. That's where all of the courses and free resources are. And then in October, I actually have my first book called The Self-Compassion Workbook for OCD, which is very similar, right? It walks you through every single step of OCD treatment, but additionally implementing the modality of compassion.
So if somebody can't access therapy for OCD, would you say that workbook is a really good start for them?
It is front to back, all of the main skills we practice in session with clients. So I work, there's several case studies, and we walk through each and every type of exposure, because there's multiple types of exposures you can do. And we explain how each and every person did that. So it's a 54,000 word back-to-back training.
Well, fun. And that's out in October, you said,
October. It's available for pre-order now on Amazon.
Someone just said, what do you think of virtual reality exposure?
Yeah, it's becoming really more and more popular. At the beginning, it was only really for like snakes and spiders and heights and planes. But now we're starting to get more and more of a inventory of different environments, and a lot of clinicians are using virtual reality. So I think that's the future of exposure therapy.
And what's the feedback been like so far? Has it all been positive?
I think that it's very good if you're wanting to do things that are hard to simulate. Like, it's hard to get on an airplane and do your exposure every day. That gets expensive. So this gives you an opportunity to do it from your home. But it's not the complete package. So you still will need to be practicing different exposures. I always say you want to go at the fear from every angle you can. Virtual reality is one of the angles, but you would still need to use other exposure models as well.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, especially with the airplane, like you said. Sitting in your living room, even though it's the entire package of the aeroplane, when you get on the aeroplane, does the mind then realize that you're not in a virtual reality simulation?
It depends on the fear, right? So if your fear is being locked in closed places, some people might have the virtual reality, but they're like, I'm in my room, so this is not my fear. Whereas if your fear is of having to sit next to somebody, that virtual reality might be really, really successful. I think as with every exposure, you can't put all your eggs in one basket. So it's if you can, the more different ways you can bring in the fear and that anxious threat response, the better. That's what we do in this work. It's hard work. We practically face our fears.
And that's what we say about anxiety disorders, isn't it? Having as many tools as you can. Because some tools work better for some people than others. Some people really react to medication wonderful. Some people it's not for. Some people love mindfulness. Some people can't adjust to it. So having all the tools and just working with a therapist, I think, is so, so important. Mm-hmm. Do you think that, like in America, for example, because it's a little bit different than in the UK where we have the National Health Service, do you think that they are going to be able to make it more accessible for the many? Or do you think that you're always going to have this stopgap in between, like the CBT school for the people that can't afford the private therapy?
Yeah, it's a really big problem, right? So I think in America with our healthcare, we've made some improvements, but I think that we're going to need more and more ways in which people can access therapy, right? Not just be face to face, because we can't do a lot of face to face with COVID right now. So I think that the good thing is we adapted to teletherapy really well. My wish would be that, you know, I say to my clients all the time, I'd love for you to put me out of business. I'd love for the healthcare system to put me out of business. That would be great. That would mean that everyone's getting the right care. But that's really a big agenda, right? I think the most important thing that people can do is do your research, because there's a lot of easy sales, right? People will say this one, you know, oil will solve, or this one medicine. And yes, that is true, but it's really important that you do your research before starting up with any kind of treatment like that.
Fantastic. Well, Kim, thank you so much for staying on. Thank you for coming back on as well when the signal went.
Sorry.
I like to say you're all clear now. Now we're going. So
I don't know what that was.
I really appreciate you answering the questions. I love obviously everything that you do. A lot of your values I really, really can relate to with my own recovery journey and just CBT research and things like that. So, yeah, just continue doing what you're doing, Kim.
Thank you.
Give impact, especially on social media as well.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Dean. I just love chatting with you. The questions are so great. So, I'm so grateful.
And no troll. Hey, Instagram are working well, aren't they?
I thought the other day that I kind of missed the troll. I don't know why I thought that. I was like, that was like, we didn't have any drama that day.
I know, and today, nothing. So fantastic. Enjoy the rest of your day, Kim. Thank you so much. And
you too.
Yeah, I just said to everyone, I'll do a swipe up as well to the CBT school. And people can see access it directly on your link in your bio as well, yeah?
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to DLC Live. Be sure to follow Dean on Instagram at DLC Anxiety. Check our website at dlcanxiety.com and grab yourself a copy of our latest book, Untangle Your Anxiety, on Amazon today. See you next time.